Life flows on like a river that homes to the sea. One now bounding through mountain vales, one now winding through a lea. None may linger on the way, none may coax time to stay. Fleeting scenes move by us like a dream. Cling not, none will be your home. Lest you grieve to be alone, go within you, there's your home. Okay. Yeah. Well, there's a triathlon out there, and as you all know, it's hard to get here, so we don't have many people today. Had we but known. Anyway, I'm happy to have us few, happy few, as band of brothers, as Shakespeare put it. And today I want to read to you from Conversations with Yogananda, the second of the sayings. Thank you. The Columbia professor had a probing mind. Among many questions asked, he asked, "How do you distinguish between yourself and your followers? All waves on the same one ocean," the master replied, "composed as ocean water is of the same substance, spirit. Some of the waves are higher than others. Some waves don't even want to distance themselves from the ocean. All waves, no matter how high, are in essence one and the same. The difference between the guru and the disciples, then, lies only in their respective closeness to the ocean, in how conscious each one is of his essential reality. The greater the sense of ego, the taller the wave, and the greater in consequence the ignorance. The greater one's awareness of the ocean as one's sole reality, the smaller the wave, and also the less sense of having a separate individuality. Professor, is there a difference, then, of evolution?" The master replied, "That much is true. If we understand every evolution to mean a progressive refinement of awareness, the tall waves participate more exuberantly in the play of delusion. The little waves, which are more enlightened, are no longer excited by the play. Enlightened beings enjoy everything, not just for itself, but as a play of God's. Professor, is there any end to evolution?" The master replied, "No end. You go on until you achieve endlessness." What a great answer. There is only one job before us on the spiritual path, and that is to overcome this sense of ego. The truth is that God is the infinite spirit. We are all waves on that infinite consciousness. We have no reality. Our bodies are nothing. Everything is consciousness. Now, why weren't people teaching that 200 years ago? Because they couldn't understand. That I am the same as you doesn't make sense. Philosophically, you can make some sort of sense of it, but literally, no. And yet now we know, and this is the benefit of science, although science has turned toward materialism, that science has also helped us to understand that matter doesn't exist except as energy. Matter can be neither destroyed, created, nor destroyed. True, but it can be converted matter really is only a manifestation of energy. And this energy is your reality behind your physical body. This body is not, it's just a vibration of energy. More than that, when God created the universe, he thought it into existence. He was and is consciousness. And God manifesting that consciousness first thought it into existence. And so you have the causal universe. Next, you have the astral universe. And when he saw that the causal universe was as he wanted, they projected those thoughts, I should say, he clothed them in bodies of energy. And he had the whole universe of astral energy. And then from that energy vibrated most grossly to assume the physical level of matter. Now, could he create further and make an even denser universe? No, he couldn't. This is the three universes that he made. When you die, you don't go back to God. You go to the astral world. Many people are afraid of death, but death is only a transition period. It doesn't really matter. It's to us, it seems terribly important. We're leaving our friends behind us. We're leaving all our possessions and familiar scenes and everything. But that's only a human view. If you look at it from a view of the divine, it's just waves coming up and going down. And what to you seems a tragedy is not. You know, when I speak of the terrible times we're headed into now, with depression and warfare and so on, I suspect, and I don't know, and I don't want this to seem like negative thinking, but from some points of view it would be. From my point of view it isn't. Because the cleansing is needed, and because a better world can only be created with fewer people. It's really, we're coming to a time when I think the big cities will be destroyed. People will have to live closer to nature. People will have to live closer to growing their own food and so on. In fact, Yogananda said that communities like Ananda will be the wave of the future. He said this idea of cooperative communities would spread like wildfire. And so we are in this transition stage right now, which means a lot of suffering, unfortunately. But God doesn't care about that. He cares about our eternal salvation in him. He cares about the long run. I remember Master saying to me with sort of a smile, a twinkle in his eyes, God eats people. Sounds like a terrible concept. And yet, the truth is that there's nothing eaten or getting or eating. It's all this, that one bliss, waves coming up and down. And this ego, now that we know that we are not this body, now that we know the body is really only energy, we can see that I'm no different from you. And in fact, the atoms that consist of your body will be in other bodies, oh, maybe other universes. It's a very cosmic play. And now it's possible to understand what it means to get rid of the ego. I've often heard of women disliking men for their egos. And yet there's just as much ego in a woman. There was something in the Second World War, a poster, join the Navy and let the world see you. Women think of themselves and how people think of them. It's just as bad an ego, whether you're aggressive or introverted. We've got to get rid of this thought that I am doing anything. He is the actor through us. He has dreamed us. So in your life, it is a good thing always to try to eliminate the thought. Anytime somebody says something that makes you think again, who, me? Do you mean me? Why do you do that? I'll defend myself. No. Try to think. When somebody insults you, thank you. may not be right, they may be right. But in the fact of taking it impartially, you eliminate a little bit of that thought, I'm being attacked. I remember in high school when I was 13 years old, and there was a 15-year-old there. I weighed 107 pounds. He weighed 230. And he decided I was an insult to the American flag. I had an English accent at the time, and I'd been in school in England. Anyway, he decided he was really going to give it to me, and I knew he meant it. And I put a dressing table in front of the door and everything. We didn't have locks on our doors. But heavily panting, he pushed that door open, came in and gave me the beating of my life. And somebody afterwards said, well, why didn't you call for help? I said, I wasn't afraid. In fact, I beat him because my attitude was so non-touched by it that he didn't know what else to do. He gave me a wide berth from then on. You must always, whatever happens to you, I remember there was a function back in Virginia, and it was to promote the idea of a community that this person wanted to start. I was the only person there who had actually started a successful community. Even so, there were a number of other famous speakers, and I suppose they were more famous because they did a lot of lecturing around the country, and it didn't matter to me at all. But I did invite them all out to dinner one night. And I was the guest. I was playing the tab, and I was one of them. But because I was not as famous as they kept talking to each other and ignoring me. I thought, this is absolutely wonderful. How nice to be unimportant. I remember there was a function, a Zen Buddhist function in San Francisco, where they were initiating a new Roshi. And afterwards, there was some young woman I was talking to outside, and I asked her name, and she told me. And then she asked me my name, and I said, well, Swami Kriyananda. Oh, Swami Kriyananda, but you're famous. I said, well, maybe, but what do you mean by, why do you use that word, but? And she said, well, all the other famous people I know seemed important. And I knew she meant seemed self-important, but I just love the idea that I'm not important. I mean, who are we really? Life passes, and I've thought of the Hollywood scene here as the more famous the actor, the darker the glasses, until finally... Finally, he needs a seeing eye, dog. But in fact, it just doesn't matter at all. You know, people's opinions are usually wrong. Why should they suddenly be right because they admire you? The important thing is to take every opportunity you can find to eliminate this emphasis on your own self. Don't think in terms of people ought to treat me better. Let them treat you as they will. Because when you can get rid of the ego you've got, you've done the whole job. Really, you don't have to overcome anything else. The whole job is getting rid of the sense that I am I. He is dreaming through you. And if you feel that he is doing it all, you know, there are several benefits that come from it. You think if you eliminate yourself, then who are you? What are you doing? You know, God created this universe from a zero. From nothingness, you can create everything. The more you think that you are nothing, the more you can do everything you want to do. Because he can do it through you. That thought of eliminating self doesn't mean to assume an attitude of irresponsibility, not at all. It means to let him be responsible, and your whole effort is to let him do things through you. The more you can do that, the more you find that he does very well. I know here in Hollywood Church, I think I mentioned this last time, that one time I was lecturing there as a minister, and a woman afterwards outside said that was a very good talk or whatever she said. And I said, well, God is the doer. Oh, really? As if I knew it was good. I didn't know it was that good. But that's not what I meant. I meant that I'll tell you what my own experience on that was, that one time I was giving a lecture in the church there. The church was filled. And I thought, well, Master told me that I should let God talk through me. Why did I just shut up and let him speak? So I stood there, waited for him to say something. I stood there for 2 full minutes, and he never said a word. So finally, I mean, other people were perspiring for fear that I had frozen with fear, but it wasn't that. I was just comfortably conducting an interesting experiment. But I found that God did not choose to speak through me in that way. And I remembered Master saying, I will reason, I will act, but guide thou my will, reason, and activity to the right path in everything. And so we have to do it with our will. We have to set that energy in motion. But beyond that, he could inspire me to say the right things. So the important thing is that we seek his guidance. We have to open our consciousness to let him enter into it and fill us. So this is the attitude of a person on the spiritual path. It's not that he sits back and does nothing. He can become intensely active for God, but he always feels God is doing it through you, through him. I've seen that the more I have that attitude, if I have a song to write, for example, I just say, well, God, I don't want a song that says this, this, and this. Give me a melody. Suddenly, instantly, it's there. This song that they sang today, What is Love? Interesting one. You know, when I got the inspiration to start writing songs, I picked up the guitar and studied a book on how to play the guitar. And was working at it as hard as I could, and I wrote 2 or 3 songs. And somebody heard me and said, would you like to give a concert? And I said, sure. A month after taking up the guitar is not the time to do a concert with the guitar. But I felt, well, it's an opportunity, and why let it go? Let's just see, at least it'll force me to practice. So I practiced like mad that whole week. And the night of the concert, it was for a Unitarian church, and somebody had told me that many Unitarians are believers in good deeds, but they don't really necessarily believe in God. So I was walking in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, and I thought about them, and suddenly this song came to me, What is Love? Everybody knows the emotion of love. Not everybody knows the feeling of devotion. But what is love if it doesn't come from something bigger than that? It's not some sort of cloud in the middle of space. It's a part of a general reality. And that love is who we are. And so with that song, I wrote 2 songs that day. And that evening, I had 5 of my new songs and whatever else I could do. I went into the hall. It was completely filled, 200 people. And they wanted to create a sense of atmosphere. So they turned out all the lights and had a candle on the altar behind me. And I desperately needed to see those guitar strings. It was not being able to see them was something of a disaster. Somebody later said, you know, I'm a music major in college, and those are some interesting chords you used. I said, yes, sir. I had no idea what they were. But it was a success. I managed to pull it off in various ways. So the thing is that if you let God do it, don't worry about yourself. And I've never been nervous as a speaker because I've never felt that it really mattered what people thought. If they think of me as a fool, and I am a fool, well, then let them know it. I want the truth. I don't want to hide anything. And so I never felt the need to be nervous. But I have felt a certain apprehension, yes. I have to admit. And is there a difference? I don't know. It's a trivial thing. Don't try. You know, one of the sayings of Emerson is a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. Don't make a big thing of trying to justify your position and say it just right so everybody thinks, well. Just don't care. You do it and leave the results in God's hands. And this is the principal teaching of the Bhagavad Gita. Nishkam karma, desire without action without desire for the fruits of action. So when you talk like this, feeling that God is doing it anyway, when you act like this and feeling that God is doing it anyway, actually what you find is that instead of having a sense of irresponsibility, you become much more responsible because you're trying to please Him. And you find that also He can do much more through you. So from all standpoints, the physical as well as the results, and for your own attitude, all of these things, they all depend on this getting rid of the ego. What happens when you really get rid of the ego? First of all, karma doesn't touch you. It may touch your body, it doesn't touch you. To be free in God means to realize you are not identified with this little body in space. You are in all bodies, in all space. I remember going with Master out at his desert retreat, and we were walking around the compound there, and several times I had to hold him. He just seemed to be unstable, and he said, it's difficult to keep this one body moving. He said, I'm in all bodies, and it's hard to remember this is the body I'm supposed to be responsible for myself. In other words, you see, there is a little ego left, as it says in the poem Samadhi, I, the cosmic sea, view the little ego floating in me. It's not that the ego ever leaves you. And in fact, this is a great reassurance that he explained to us. Honestly, his explanations of the way the universe works, of the truths of this Bhagavad Gita, the Indian scriptures, of the Christian scriptures, all the history of 2,000 years of theological squabbling and so on. Absolutely amazing how he addressed every one of them. He was no scholar, but intuitively he knew these are the things to be addressed. And he made it very clear that, yes, the ego, we have to give up everything, but do you really have to give up yourself? This is the fear that people have in trying to transcend the ego. No, but you don't. The thought of becoming humble by becoming nothing is not really it. It's because you become everything. When you spurn this thought of I being this little body, you find you're in all bodies. This is the goal of humility, not self-abasement. This is what's wrong about monastic obedience. Obedience to a true guru is one thing, because he tells you those things to do which will help you to get out of the ego. But those monasteries where they've told nuns to plant plants upside down, totally against their own reason, only to teach them obedience, that is the wrong kind of obedience. We must learn to be obedient to our own higher self. When Master put me in charge of the other monks, I said to them, I don't want you to obey me. I know it's traditional for somebody in my position to expect that kind of obedience. I don't ask that. All I ask is your cooperation, willing cooperation. Be willing to cooperate, but if you feel I'm wrong, don't do it. Obey the truth in your own being. This is the most important thing. So, My message today is to seek the truth by getting rid of the ego. Do we have any questions? Any questions?
We're going to bring some microphones around so that it can be heard by everyone.
Yes, in this light I can't see. I wish Hi, there Swami. Were better light in here.
It's Hi, Swami. Like, my name is Vajrini.
What is your name?
Vajrini.
Okay.
My question is the way that the ego and love interact. You were speaking about love and how love is
ego
there.
And
ego and love interact.
How well, when there is ego in love, there's the thought of what I'm getting out of my being with you. If I love you, I'm thinking that it's giving me pleasure. In true love, in divine love, there's only the thought of giving. And then that thought of giving, mind you, in ego too, there are two directions for the ego. One is what I'm getting out of it. The other is what I can give to it. Giving is a good thing. Receiving is a limiting thing. We want that which will help us to expand our egos and not that which will make them shrink in upon ourselves. So Master often said that higher even than love is bliss. Because if you love God for love's sake, there may be thought of it, what's in it for me? You love me kind of thing. In bliss there's no thought of self at all. The love, if it's truly giving, is a good expression of ego. Okay? You're giving of yourself, you're expanding yourself. In this, love is a beautiful virtue. If you think in terms of what you get out of it, that is desire, that is not love. Okay?
More about what's expected to happen in the next few years.
Could you say more about what's expected to happen in the next few years?
Okay, well, Master talked frequently about a depression. They talk of the Great Depression of the 30s. He said this will be much, much worse. Honestly, I can visualize a time when trucks bringing food won't be able to get into the inner cities because they'll be stopped by mobs seeking food outside the cities. I think the inner cities is going to be a dangerous place to be. And living in the cities also, if you can't grow your own food, it will be very dangerous. I remember a prophecy I had in India, which is a story in itself and very interesting, but I won't go into it right now. But it spoke of the future when there will be weeping in every home. There is going to be a great deal of suffering, and that will lead probably to world war. I see right now Pakistan and India becoming more and more tense. I see China defending Pakistan. Yogananda said the next war would involve India. He didn't speak of Pakistan. It didn't exist then, but China, Russia, Germany. He said there would be another war. It would involve the whole world. He said America would be saved in the end because America has good karma. America hasn't had all the centuries that they've had in Europe to develop bad karma. And the attitude of the Americans is basically very generous. The Americans, they used to say that if the Americans were during the race to get somebody on the moon, if the Americans would only spend enough money to get a dog on the moon, they would worry so much about that dog that they would put forth all their effort to bring it back. Well, that's really the American attitude toward things. And this good karma, we have bad karma also, particularly in the way we treated the American Indians. And the way we treated the blacks, Master didn't talk so much about it. Let me try to figure out why he wouldn't, because certainly the suffering of the slaves was great. But the thing is, first of all, most of those slaves were sold by their own people to the West. Secondly, back in a descending era, all Africa and Egypt fell into black magic. There's a lot of black magic still being practiced in Africa. That is bad karma. And so it is known as the Dark Continent. There isn't the same enlightenment there. You find that every country that has taken over from the white people in Africa has become, in overnight almost, completely a non-country. But that will change. And a friend of ours, Ram, he's a black man, and I've been trying to persuade him to come here and work in Watts and help the blacks there to understand this deeper philosophy, and I hope he will. But there's a time now for the black nations to come up again. And I think a part of that wave was these slaves coming here when they got out of slavery. Now the blacks are equal to the whites. And you see that they're just as intelligent, just as competent. But they are the ones who can go back to Africa and lift up Africa too. So when Ram went to Nigeria, he said, now I understand the positive side of slavery, that through this it can uplift a whole continent. So there are pluses and minuses in this. Slavery was a terrible institution, but at the same time it created a situation socially that can also help uplift many people. I have a lot of hope for the people in Los Angeles, especially. There are so many black people here. But how many people, I can't go into their churches. Ram could. You don't see many black people at my talks. They could be here. We have several black members of our community, but a very small number. I'd like to see that change. Because really, Master used to say, you talk of black and white, you take the skin off, they're all red. There's no such thing as color. It's a delusion. He said the real races of men are the caste system. People who are of low consciousness, higher consciousness, still higher, and highest. And an accountant living next to an ashram will have more in common with an accountant in China or in Africa than he will with his own neighbors. It's our consciousness that draws us together. So America's karma is basically good. And because of that, America will not be defeatable. Russia, who seems to be very powerful, he said, Europe will be devastated. Russia will be annihilated. And it hurts me to think, because we have some wonderful devotees in Russia. And there are wonderful people everywhere. But remember this, in 100 years, everybody living today will be gone. Virtually everybody. Death is nothing. Death is just taking off an overcoat and going into the other room. It's painful at the moment, but you go into a new world, a new life, a new family, and everything keeps coming again and again. And the thing is, the same old people that you've known will be with you again and again and again. How many times have I gone down the streets of a city and looked at so many people, and they're just old friends? I remember this one program I was on in India, a television program, and there were about 100 people there. Every one of them looked like an old friend to me, either friend or old family member. Many of us have known each other before. And you look, don't look at the face, look at the eyes. But in the eyes you can see, there you can recognize people. There's a certain familiarity. And the amazing thing, look what God can do with two eyes, a nose, and a mouth. It's almost, how can you make that much variety? No two people look exactly alike. And mostly in the eyes. This is a wonderful thing Master said. Shankaracharya, the ancient sage, said that God is Satchidananda, and it's been translated variously. Existence, consciousness, bliss doesn't mean anything. But what Master explained is ever existing, ever conscious, and this is the clincher, ever new bliss. This thought is something very important to understand. He didn't talk about it much. But ever new means that every expression of bliss is new. You are your own expression of bliss, and you, no one in all eternity will ever have the same expression. You are unique in your own inner self. It's such a strange thing. All the waves go back into the ocean. Nothing remains but the ocean. But in omniscience, there always remains that memory. The beauty of it is that you will never lose who you are. Sean Mashore will remain Sean Mashore through eternity. He won't be the same person, but he'll have the same ego sense, the same I sense, which is much deeper than the ego. And when you develop that consciousness, you see that you can't help loving everybody when you know that that's what they all are. They all want the same bliss. They all are that bliss. You don't have to attain anything. All you need to do is eliminate the coverings that make it look different. You are that already. You are Christ. You are no different from Christ. The only difference, as Master said, here is one of evolution. But evolution doesn't mean becoming something different. It means getting rid of sheaths, as they said. Ram was talking in Italy, and the word for sheath in Sanskrit is kosha. The word for thighs in Italian is kosha. And so he was saying, you've got to get rid of these thighs. I didn't know what he was talking about. But you need to get rid of those sheaths of self-definition. Don't define yourself as a man or a woman. Try to get rid of all self-definition. Don't say, I'm an American, I'm rich, I'm poor, I'm old, I'm young. I'm 84, but I don't think of myself as any age. We aren't our age. That changes. Be that self in yourself, which never changes. And the more you can do that, the more you realize that this eternal now is who you really are, and that is unique in you. That's the beautiful thing. Not only does everybody have his own unique path to God, everybody in some way sees God a little bit differently. That's why monastic rules are a great mistake. You can't impose one rule on everybody. Everybody has to seek that truth differently. At Ananda, we respect people's individuality. We say, this is the goal. Go at it as you can. And as you do, you'll find you unfold in your own way. I have a sense of humor. I've known great saints who had no sense of humor. What difference did it make? You could see that same bliss in their eyes. This one great master I stayed with for 4 days in India, I never saw him smile, but I saw this twinkle of bliss in his eyes. That's the most important thing. And your own unique expression of it, your own unique path to it, it makes the whole universe so incredibly wonderful in its vast, vast variety. So, what was I talking about here? Yeah. Okay, well, that will lead to war. And that war will be devastating. I think that it may. I mean, just think of an atom bomb. Right now, there are 35 known atomic weapons. 35,000 known atomic weapons. That doesn't take into account the unknown ones. You unleash one, and you'll certainly get others following. People retaliate. No, the First World War lasted 4 years. I mean, the Second World War. First also, I believe, I'm not sure. They had the Hundred Years' Wars back in the medieval times. Nowadays, a war is very short. An atomic war could be 2 weeks, but it could really devastate. Not only that, but when karma is heavy, it attracts other things too. Retaliation or whatever from the universe. We're living in a cosmic universe, a cosmic environment. We're not just living on this little earth, independent of the rest of the universe. And it often happens that great cataclysms occur during times of great evil and suffering and upheaval. Master one time was lecturing in Hollywood Church, and he paused in his lecture, and he said, "You don't know what a terrible cataclysm is coming." Well, a cataclysm doesn't usually mean something man-made. It means something cosmic. I have heard Padre Pio, a great saint in southern Italy, Master too, I'm told, although I didn't read this myself, one or two other people have talked about 3 days of darkness. And I've asked myself, how could those 3 days occur? One could be that a heavenly body would hit the earth with such impact that it would keep it from moving for 3 days until the inner momentum began to increase enough to set the planet moving again. I don't know if that would explain it. There may well be other explanations, but the truth remains that these great saints who have seen the future told us that this would happen. I know that there's another point, and let me make this very, it's a very important point, so let me say it very clearly. Somebody had the, he decided to try to regress people under hypnosis to before this life and ask them why they had chosen to be born at this time. All of them knew that they were coming into a period of great difficulty. Not one of them was afraid of that. Every one said that it was a time of great spiritual opportunity. So don't think of it in terms of an obstacle. Think of it as the opportunity for spiritual growth. It will cleanse the planet. It will cleanse you. And nothing that ever happens is a misfortune. So yes, we are coming to a time of difficulty, and I don't think it will last very long. After that, however, and how many people will survive this, I don't know. But I suspect it won't be that many. But after that, Master said, "I prophesy you will see a new world, a world of peace and prosperity. There will be no more wars for 300 years. People will be so tired of fighting." And yes, these are serious things to consider. Master said again and again with great force, pleading with people, he said, "Get land in the country. Go out there with a few friends. Pool your resources. Get the land. Go out there and live simply and grow your own food. Have simple clothing. You don't have to have mink stoles and stuff, which, of course, people don't wear anymore anyway. But you don't need all the luxury with which you surround yourselves. Just live a quiet life. You can have a small cabin, a teepee even. When we began Ananda, many people began by living in teepees. It was great fun, actually. So if you think of that, please take my word seriously. It will be much less of a shock. Even if you have that land out there, go out on weekends to develop it. But have it there ready so that if you see the times coming when it's time to get out, you'll have somewhere to go. Otherwise, you'll be on the highways in throngs trying to get somewhere and not knowing where to go. So that is our solution that Master recommended. Get land in the country where you can grow your own food, build your own buildings, even make your own clothes. And living among people who are seeking the same high ideals, there's no happier way of life that I can offer you. I started in Ananda about 42 years ago, and it's flourishing. I can say that it is a successful experiment. It works. please take it seriously. Anyway, that is what is ahead of us right now. And whether it comes today, tomorrow, or next week, or in a year, I do think it's coming. And I do think we're on the eve of it right now. And that big prophecy about 2012, I know nothing about it. But I know we're heading into difficult times. Okay? Any other questions?
I saw you at Forest Lawn earlier, and you mentioned that
he
God...
saw you at Forest Lawn.
For the memorial.
Okay, okay.
And you mentioned then also, you said that Yogananda had said that God eats people. And that really stuck with me, and I just thought if you had a
I was so intrigued by that concept. You know, in India, they eat with their right hand. He said, God eats people. So that what were you going to say? It means that you have your body, you'll have to give it into the infinite. God isn't there like a man. It's that the universe absorbs and gives back and absorbs and gives back. And you have to understand this about God, that he is not particularly interested in us as individuals. He's interested in us as souls. People say, how could God allow this suffering? Well, we need that suffering to grow. We need to develop a sort of impersonal attitude toward ourselves so that the worst pains that we have to go through, the worst suffering, we have to accept we've done the karma, we've committed the acts that brought this result. It isn't that God wishes it upon us. But having received it, we must not take it personally. Everybody who suffers thinks, no one's ever suffered as much as I have. Well, don't be like that. Just say it's not suffering. I know if tomorrow I have to go to the dentist. Well, I haven't been to a dentist for 2 years. I expect a little trouble. I hope I don't get it. But the thing is that I've never let it bother me. I've never taken Novocaine. And when they're there drilling or whatever it is, I just say, this isn't my body. And I maybe write music while the dentist is drilling, or think of some passage in a book that I want to clarify. I just don't put my mind on it. The more we can develop that impersonal attitude, and that's what Master was trying to develop in us, know that this body is going to go. What does it matter? This life, it'll just be a part of history. We need to develop that impersonal attitude that allows everything to come and go. His master said, what comes of itself, let it come. What does it matter? You'll find that in that, there's a great deal of freedom. So, is that okay? Okay. But that is, I can't forget that expression, God eats people. But he loves your soul. And he loves you too, in the way that you love a little child. When he falls and hurts himself and cries, you know it's not serious. And yet you say, oh, Bobby, I'm so sorry. And you try to come down to his level. So God comes down to our level in a way, but inside he knows that I'll get over it. He's trying to develop, I'm trying to help you develop that impersonal attitude that comes with true maturity. Any other questions?
Swami, I have a question. I wanted to ask you about tips for the best way to handle when you get angry or irritated, annoyed.
Yeah. Well, the first thing is physically to relax your heart. It's here that the anger begins. And if you can just say, be calm here. They say before you answer, take 10 breaths, or count to 10. The one thing to remember with anger is that what you say under the influence of anger will almost always hurt something. It'll destroy a relationship. Master used to say that the mouth is like a cannon and the words are like bullets. And if you use those words wrongly, they can destroy friendships. Many things have been destroyed by anger. Never act in anger, because that's a delusion which will cause you to disturb the natural flow of events. So the next thing is, I would say, take a few deep breaths and then try to think, will I feel this way a year from now? No. Then why get so tied up in my feelings of the moment? Somebody insults you, somebody does something wrong. Just, it's not my reality. Why should I let his action touch me? Sometimes when people really treat you badly, try to destroy you, and this does happen, don't change your love for them for one simple reason, that you are happier if you love them. Whereas if you enter into that and get angry, you're the one who's losing. You shrink your consciousness inward upon the ego, and you build a sort of a wall around yourself. It's very important to break down those walls, so to accept whatever comes of itself, let it come. When I was thrown out of SRF, that was a very painful experience for me, because I had given my entire life to serving Master through that organization, and suddenly it was taken away from me. I really thought for a while maybe Master himself had abandoned me, but he had given me his unconditional love. I said, but still it seems as if you have abandoned me. And I said, but I will not abandon you. You have responsibility for only one thing in the universe, and that's your own reactions. So I determined to continue to love them in spite of how they treated me, if only because I was happier loving, and I would be miserable if I became angry or resentful or bitter. So for your own sake, have the right attitudes. You can change people much better with understanding than with anger. Okay? That touch what you were... Or is there more?
That's great, thanks.
Okay. Any other questions?
Morning. So can you maybe give some advice about what we can do when there are moments in our lives when we are affected by what people say or fear of a particular outcome or when we're in resistance?
Could you help me with that?
Can you give some advice about those moments when we are affected by what other people say, fear, resistance to outcomes?
I would say always try to focus your eyes on the horizon. I know it's not easy, because of course we have our ideals. We have this is the ideal attitude to have, but we don't have that attitude. So what do we do in the meantime? If you think of the horizon, which is far away, don't think just where you're standing right now, but there. Gradually, it's not as if you will immediately overcome these things, but in time you'll find yourself becoming more and more detached. I know there was one person, he was a member of our community, and he was one of the first members, and so I let him stay there, although he didn't give his usual contribution to the community's finances, which everybody does give. And I let him stay there. But he always, in every satsang, he would try to ask me some question that would embarrass me. Always he tried to say something that would make me feel badly. And I just let it be. It didn't matter to me. But finally, we got a new general manager. And this general manager said to him that you've been doing this now for 12 years, living here and carping. What good does it do what good are you doing with this? He said, you haven't paid your rent for all these years and we've let you do it. Can you now pay that rent? And why have you had this negative attitude? And he said, well, I think it helps the community to have one or two carping voices. And the general manager said, well, you may be right. It may help the community. What's it doing for you? And he didn't have an answer to that. So the new manager said, I have to give you this alternative. Now, from now on, pay the rent or leave the community. So he chose to leave the community. And he came and spent an hour telling me all the things that were wrong with me. For instance, my sonata. I had written this piano sonata, and the first movement he said he thought ought to have words. And he said, in the end, you put words in. As if we'll see how right I was. He was telling me how my life was a complete failure in all departments. There was nothing I was amounting to. And I sat and listened to this diatribe for 1 hour. At the end of it, I thanked him. And he left. This person who was in the other room, he said he couldn't believe the conversation. But he worked it out by writing one of my most beautiful songs. The green summer fade and winter draw near, my Lord, in your presence I live without fear. And if you can always inwardly, no matter what happens outwardly, develop that attitude. I know it doesn't take overnight. There are no 90-day wonders on this path. But you'll be amazed how much happier you yourself become if every day you try to practice this principle. The most important thing is your emotions, and they always spring from the heart. If you can calm those emotions, if you can trace them back to their source and not think of them as out here, something you can't control, you can control your reactions. Kriya is a wonderful technique for helping to control these reactions, because the reactive process is in the spine, in the movement of energy in the Ida and Pingala nerve channels in the spine. I can't go into that in depth for those who don't know what the hell I'm talking about. But if you can do Kriya, every day you'll gradually bring yourself back to that realization that your reactions spring not from outside, not from what's happening, but from your own self. And if you can get your own self under control, breathing is a large part of it. When you inhale, the energy comes up the spine. When you exhale, it automatically goes down. And if you can bring it in like that, from that center, you'll find yourself, even with the practice of Kriya, becoming more and more detached. Your reactions will be impersonal. And you will be able, even in bad situations, to bring the energy up to see it, make you feel a good reaction. I remember one time I fell suddenly, I was new on the path, and I fell suddenly into this mood. And I tried to reason my way out of it. Reason just didn't do it, because reason follows feeling. And so then I thought, well, if reasoning won't do it, what can we do? And I asked my mental citizens, you might say, what are we going to do, boys? And they said, why don't we try changing our level of consciousness? So I went into my meditation room, put my mind here, focused it here for 5 minutes, with great determination. After 5 minutes, my mood was completely different. I felt, of course, people act that way. There's nothing to get excited about. My whole attitude was different. So if you work on your inner self through bringing the reactions into a positive flow, changing your level of consciousness, when it's low, your reactions will be low. When it's high, they'll always be beatific. So the more you change yourself, the more everything appears different. These are important teachings. Really practice them. You'll see that your life will change thereby. Okay? Any other questions?
I think it's working. Oh, okay.
Is that?
She's starting.
Namaste. Swamiji, my question is that when I do meditation, I can do it for a long length of time, but then I don't, it's hard to explain, but it seems like I have a hard time coming back. So I just want to stay there in stillness. What do you recommend? How do?
You know, when Sri Yukteswar gave Samadhi the first time to Master, and then he handed him a broom. He said, let's sweep the porch. We have to learn to balance the inner and the outer world. It takes willpower, but it's certainly one of the lessons on the spiritual path to be inwardly in God and yet outwardly active in the world. And for a long time in the beginning, that bliss that you feel inside is so wonderful you don't want to come out into the world. You have to use willpower to do it. You have a family or work or responsibilities of one kind or another. Always see that God is in those two and that there's no difference between God in the broom and God in the infinite. It's all God. But these are also the lessons to be learned. How to have the right attitude, how to be forgiving and loving and centered in yourself, and at the same time, how to have that inward attitude and yet be outwardly active. These are the two plays of Maya. Okay? Well, I think we've talked enough. Let's have a little satsang outside, and then we'll, Thank you all.